Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Kate Bond. I live in Portland, Maine, and I have been organizing for the past 4 years with a healthcare as a human right campaign as a member of the Southern Maine Worker Center, which is a human rights organization that organizes and does movement building to improve the working conditions of poor and working class folks in Maine.
And so Maine's governor, for people who have not paid attention, was kind of the original proto-Trump. He's this blustery, very right-wing figure who makes his name sort of beating up on welfare and poor people and whatever. So I thought it would be interesting to start out talking a little bit about what it's been like in Maine living and organizing under LePage and how that gives you some insight into what living and organizing under Trump is like.
Yeah. I mean, during the presidential campaign, I think that's some of what folks at the Worker Center were feeling, is that all of the things that Trump was out there saying were really familiar to us. And we have been here with Governor LePage for a while. It's tough because the big difference between Trump and LePage is really money. LePage is a tough figure because he is not a wealthy person. He never has been. He actually comes from poverty, spent time as a young person being homeless on the streets, and came from a home where there was a lot of domestic violence that he's really public about. So, but similar to Trump, he hates on poor folks all the time. He is constantly telling people to go back to work. And he's really focused a lot on villainizing Maine's growing African immigrant population, and sort of blaming the opioid crisis here in Maine, which is now, a Mainer is dying at a rate of at least one person a day from a heroin overdose here. And he's blaming that on out-of-state folks who are Black coming from New York City to peddle drugs here. So while he uses a lot of the same rhetoric as Trump, I think our challenge has been that he has some credibility with people in Maine because he does come from poverty. Yeah. And they see him as someone who's really worked his way up, and who, tells it like it is or whatever. Uh-huh. And there are a lot of people, Maine is we're the oldest state in the nation. Right. We are one of the more rural states in the nation. And we are also one of those places where a lot of mill jobs used to exist, right? And factory jobs and right. Jobs that are never coming back. And so a lot of white people who are really looking for somebody to tell them why they're all so poor, or why they're working so hard but can't get anywhere, right? And so we've been up against that narrative for quite a while here on the state level, and so it has looked like all of the things you could imagine, trying to completely, we've kicked so many people off food stamps over the past 6 years. We have, and that's touted as look at all the people who are off food stamps who got jobs, right?
Right.
And we know it's not true. So kicking people off food stamps, creating barriers for general assistance, which is housing, food, and medicine vouchers,
right.
Especially trying to kick immigrants off of those programs. It's looked like a tax on our public school teachers. It's looked like trying to sell the idea that more law enforcement is going to solve our drug problem. And so it's looked like all of those things. And it's pretty bleak. And so right now we're in a budget process at the state level where he's trying to eliminate $65 million from the budget almost entirely out of the Health and Human Services side of the budget. So, you know, trying to kick more people off Medicaid, he refused to expand Medicaid. So we're one of those states where we've never had Medicaid expansion, and each, you know, all the time, each budget, he's been trying to kick more and more people off. So right now they're trying to kick 19 and 20 year olds off of Medicaid in Maine. So it's pretty bad. Yeah. Let's just say that's the bleak part.
The question of the Medicaid expansion, this is something I've been thinking about since, because of course, Trump and there, all the Republicans basically ran on repealing the Affordable Care Act. In states like Maine, where they didn't see a lot of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act, do you think that that argument sort of had more value as people were saying, got more purchase with people because they hadn't felt the benefits of it in the first place?
Oh, like the anti-ACA
rhetoric? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, and so I've been, like, the Worker Center and the Healthcare is Human Right campaign for the past 4 years. One of the things we've been doing is going out and gathering people's healthcare stories using this sort of survey. So canvassing and meeting people at food pantries and public libraries and festivals and fairs and, like, all this stuff to say, like, how are you experiencing the healthcare system we have now?
Right.
And when we started, you know, 4 years ago, a lot of people were in the midst of trying to figure out the ACA, right, and trying to figure out how to sign up for it and if it would work for them. And there was a lot of people who were really disgruntled. And I do think because Medicaid wasn't expanded, that's part of it.
Right. Yeah.
Really, people's biggest issue that I heard over and over again is, like, first of all, it's confusing. Like, people, the rollout of the ACA, people were very confused, right? And right. So, you know, there were navigators and stuff available, but people were really confused about how to even figure out if they could get a good plan for the ACA.
Right.
But mostly people were pissed that they were being fined for not being able to afford the ACA.
Right.
And of course, a lot of those folks, had we expanded Medicaid, this wouldn't have been such a pervasive problem.
Right.
But when, you know, as an organizer, when people were telling me, I can't believe I have to pay a fine for not having coverage because I'm too poor, I said, right. Yeah, that sucks.
Right.
my response was to validate that. And I was also one of those people
right.
who couldn't, you know, had to pay a fine and, right. at tax season.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, so, if you don't have the expansion, then those two things interact in a really unpleasant
right.
way.
Yeah. So people were, I do think not having Medicaid expansion created a climate paired with, like, LePage's narrative about, you know, everything about Obama being terrible. I do think, like, those things paired together gave people a sort of story about why healthcare wasn't working. But, you know, in my experience, like, talking to people and really engaging them and listening to them, they might start a conversation saying one thing, like, you know, the ACA is the problem or whatever. And then by the end of the conversation, we really usually ended up in a place where they were like, oh yeah, I mean, having any insurance companies involved making money off of healthcare is wrong, right? Like, that's always going to go wrong. So what we were trying to do was, like, engage people wherever they were at, whether they had lost their Medicaid, whether they were still on Medicaid, whether they got something through the ACA, or whether they had no insurance at all, or even employer-based insurance. And we were trying to engage all those folks to figure out, like, what are the real roots of the problem? And we know that, like, everything right now is about protecting the ACA.
Yeah.
But we know that the ACA has not served the folks that we're out here trying to organize.
Right.
Not in the way that it could. We also know that, like, taking away healthcare is always bad.
Right.
So we're obviously against taking away healthcare.
Right.
We have absolutely met people who were, you know, saying, like, the ACA is not perfect and it's frustrating, but it means I have healthcare that I desperately need. So we've just been listening and really leading from the place of people's own knowledge about their lived experience and what does it tell them and how do we help them unpack. Like, so given all that you've experienced and what you're telling me, who do you think the real enemy is here? And the enemy is, like, a profit-driven system. Like, that's everybody's enemy. It doesn't
right.
work for anybody who is an ordinary person. And so even in the midst right now of, you know, don't repeal without replacing, or right. don't defund Planned Parenthood, and all of the crises that are going on, all of the calls to save healthcare, you know.
Yeah.
I was at a rally recently in Maine where someone was saying, save our care, after a person who a person had just spoken who is an immigrant seeking asylum here, who works full time, who cannot afford anything through the ACA or through his employer right now. He cannot reasonably afford that. And yeah. he had just talked about how he had no care except free care through a hospital for yeah. emergencies. And then there's, you know, a white woman from Maine screaming like, save our care. And I'm thinking, yes, but who's the hour and who's actually been receiving care and who has been living in this gap all this time?
Yeah.
Right. And those are the folks that we're trying to engage.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to go back and touch on the question of the opioid crisis. Talking about how this has affected Maine in particular, again, as the oldest state, as one of, if not the whitest states, and a very rural state where this has hit really hard and where, again, where healthcare has been not only a political football, but has legitimately like not been expanded to people.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, it's really messed up that that it has taken this crisis reaching middle and upper class white people for people to pay attention. So like flat out, it's really, to me, it's a crisis of empathy and humanity, and it's about racism. Yeah. When I look at it and think about like, but you know, we are in this state that's like 95% white. Yeah. And so of course, the majority of people who are dying in this epidemic are white people. I think about like what it means. yeah, it's hard too because all of us have lost people. So I'll say that like I've lost people that I love and to this, and I don't know anyone who hasn't. And so when we are talking about it, it's like both deeply personal for people. Because we're literally watching our communities die, right? And that's really rough. But the way that, like, to have both to be in a moment where people are dying from using drugs, and we're also shrinking whatever public safety net has been left, to me, it's so ridiculous to live in a place where people don't see that this is a public health crisis that has its roots in poverty. Mm-hmm. Also, I would say in the like white denial, like people not wanting to believe that this could be such a big problem amongst white people, but we're in a moment where we're like completely shrinking our safety net. I would say that it's not just the Republican folks who have been kind of, have been about like pushing law enforcement over care, increasing access to care. It's not just them. You know, here in Portland, we have an all Democratic city council that chose to shut down one of the premier, like in the country, clinics that has a needle exchange, that has an HIV positive program and does STD testing and counseling, that was serving folks on the street, really low income people. Had incredible relationships to their providers. This clinic, India Street Clinic, was reaching people that no one else could reach, and doing a really good job at harm reduction and using this very progressive model that other folks in, you know, nationally have looked at and been like, wow, that's a great model. And our all Democrat city council decided that, you know, we don't want to be in quote unquote the business of healthcare, and they were going to defund it and try to shift services over to a federally qualified health center in town that did not have those relationships, that did not have the skill. And they just wiped it out, you know, and there was a big public fight to save it, and we lost. And so, in the midst of a crisis where everybody's, you know, friends and brothers and sisters are dying, we're eliminating things that work. And so there are some amazing people in Maine who are starting to get it, and people who are pushing harm reduction models and pushing for expanding services under Medicaid to cover addiction. And there are a lot of people doing really good work in the midst of, you know, this really crappy narrative that law enforcement is the answer. And that if we just put more people in jail and we just do more raids and confiscate more drugs, that we're going to get better. And you know, that's just not, we know that's not true. We know it's not going to work. So I would say that there are people in Maine who are doing incredible work on harm reduction and also fighting for services that will actually connect people to life-saving resources, right? And, you know, we cannot solve this without taking seriously how we fight poverty. Like, we take poverty as a given, and we accept these folks as casualties, and that's pretty repulsive, right? Like, that's, that's a pretty bleak view.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most striking, you know, after the election, people were overlaying, you know, the Trump vote onto various different other maps of things. And the one that really struck me was the Trump vote overlaid with the opioid crisis. And that, you know, you have people who are literally dying, who are looking for something, anything that's going to make their lives better. And it's really, you know, and the response from, I find, far too many Democrats was, well, they deserve what they get. And that really, yeah, when you're living and seeing that around you, it's really hard to write people off as just terrible people because of who they voted for.
Yes. And I think, I mean, I agree with all the things about like Democrats being elitist and really just not liking poor people any more than Republicans do at the end of the day. Yeah. I don't believe the Democratic Party cares more about poor people than the Republican Party as a whole.
Yeah.
And I think if we did, we would have had really different things happen. But I also think like we have to strike this balance about saying, okay, there is a narrative out there that, you know, from Trump, like we're going to, and from LePage, we're going to bring these jobs back. We're going to build jobs by doing X, Y, and Z. That does resonate for people who are on that line or in poverty, sure. But there's also a way to come out strong against white supremacy and xenophobia and also a message that resonates with working class people who are white and poor people who are white. And like, the Democrat Party is not coming out strong enough against the really easy scapegoating narratives. And so it matters in Maine that our governor is saying, oh, the drugs are coming in with black men from New York and they're the ones bringing in these drugs and, you know, saying wild things like they're coming here, bringing drugs and impregnating some white girl and then going back home. And I mean, he says these things that are really provocative and people will at that point come out against him and, you know, be like, oh, you gotta apologize for this statement, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But he also says things that aren't quite that outlandish, but are just as dangerous and people are okay to sit tight with that. And so, you know, there needs to be a stronger and more nuanced story. And I think one of the things We can't just look at the white working class in this country and say, well, we have empathy for your suffering that's caused by like economic injustice. Like, absolutely. And there are white working class folks in this country who would rather go hungry themselves than push for policies that give immigrants GA2, right? So like in our state, there are like the majority of people who use general assistance are white because the majority of our population is white.
Right.
But our governor has framed general assistance as a program that asylum seekers from Central African countries are using. And therefore people are okay to push for example, the elimination of the entire program when it's going to mostly hurt white people.
Right.
It's going to really, really hurt this population of immigrants who do not have another legal means of income to support themselves before they have work permits. It's going to absolutely disproportionately hurt them. And it's like you would rather chop off your own arm than see bread in your brother's mouth. That is true. And that is white supremacy. And like for me, as a white person in Maine, to be facing that head on with other white people and say like, how is it you'd rather see your kid go hungry than see some immigrant dude who lives next to you eat? Like, how is that? Like, you're okay with both, you know, you're like, well, I'll take it from him even though it's taking from me too. The only answer to that illogical, like, that's illogical, but the only answer is white supremacy is that strong.
Yeah.
And And so we need to really dig deep in there and say, like, whoa, how wild is that? That these policies have always been hurting white working class people and poor people. And yet we've charged ahead and we've said, okay, as long as it's hurting them,
yeah,
we're cool. And that's like, that's not something that I think the Democratic Party wants to talk just about economics. And you can't. There is something that white supremacy does for white people.
Yeah.
There is stuff that we get from it that is not always tangible and sometimes even antithetical to our own material well-being, and we still choose it again and again. And so there are ways to, for me, working on a healthcare as a human right campaign, I'm trying to get healthcare for every single person who lives here, no matter what,
yeah,
that is comprehensive and dignifies them. And that working on an issue that is across, you know, it's a universal human need, allows me to dig into some of those conversations,
yeah,
with people in a nuanced way. Yeah. Right. And I've seen some success with that.
Yeah. Talk more about that. Cause I'm the whole point of doing this interview series is to give people some ideas of things that are working. So yeah, talk about the ways that the healthcare campaign has allowed you to talk about that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, so like the single payer movement has been around for a long, long time. Right. And
right,
there have always been people calling for a universal health program in this country. What the Healthcare as a Human Right campaign does differently, by using a human rights framework and by using not just a legislative strategy,
right,
or even like a ballot initiative strategy, we are trying to do true base building that actually engages people around, like, what are your rights?
Right.
Do you know them? Do you claim them? And then do you demand a different life based on really knowing that you have human rights? And so a lot of, you know, some single payer folks are really scared of that model. And I've talked with people we partner with, where we've had to do a lot of work to say, you know, we've gotten pushback saying that's too bold a model. That's going to alienate the average person, right? And what they mean by the average person is probably a conservative white person who maybe doesn't have a lot of money,
yeah,
and maybe doesn't have a lot of education. This is what I assume they mean, that they're afraid that it alienates those people by saying human rights. And so they've been afraid of that bold messaging. And what I found is it is the opposite. For me, if I go up to someone and I just shove a policy solution at them and say, sign on to this, they're a lot more likely to be like, no, why are you talking to me like that, right? Like, you're just talking at somebody. What we have done is engage people on values, and talk to them about what they think human rights are and what it means to their lives. And the response that I've got is that whether people have a good or negative reaction to it, they have a reaction that causes them to engage. And that they're making such a bold claim, which is sad that it's a bold claim, but whatever. making such a bold claim actually gives us room to nudge people's analysis forward. So like the one example that, you know, that I use sometimes because it really, to me, it's a really powerful example is that I was at a library in Biddeford, just kind of hanging around with snacks and like inviting people to come chat with me. And Biddeford is this, you know, it's a low income town. It's one of those places that's on a river, and Biddeford and Saco. So Saco was where the managers lived in the mills, and Biddeford is where the workers lived. And
yeah,
it's a place that has a lot of low income folks and a lot of a real, like, the drug problems there are really serious. So I'm just hanging out in the library and being like, you want some food? Do you want to talk to me? And a woman comes in with her son in tow, her like 8 or 9 year old son. And she's like, I heard you're back here talking to people about healthcare, and I'm just so mad and I really want to talk to you. And I'm like, well, you know, great. This is like an organizer's dream. You want to talk to me? Great. But I'm worried that she's going to yell at me. Right. I'm like, oh, she's really worked up.
Right.
And she launches in saying that she voted for LePage twice,
yeah,
you know, both times. She really likes a lot of the things he's doing. And also, she's really pissed because she just lost her health care. She just lost her major.
Yeah.
And now her son will still get health care, but she won't. And she's just feeling furious, right? So she's like a single mom who works full time, who barely makes ends meet. And she says, like, how is it possible that my son can get health care and I can't? And what if something happens to me? Who takes care of him? Like, if I can't take care of him, how is that good for him? And so we, you know, we launch in and we're really, she's just telling me all of her stuff and we're talking. And then we get to this part of our conversation where I say, well, do you believe healthcare is a human right? And, you know, she immediately says, well, yeah, but not for immigrants. They're not from here. And I don't think we should give them anything. And so this question about human rights, it is bold enough to make people come out with what they really believe.
Yeah.
And I was able to ask her. So then she starts telling me how they, you know, how they act and how they soak up all these resources and they don't work hard and stuff like that. And I'm just able to ask her, do you know folks like that? Do you really know people that you're describing? And she pauses and says, like, no, not really. I've read about them in the news. And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, yeah, you know, I hear a lot of people tell those stories too. Let me tell you about the immigrant people I've met who have told me their stories. And what I've heard from them is that they're often mothers who are worried about their children just like you are. And you just told me that being a mother and protecting your son is one of the most important things to you. And I'm telling you that these immigrant women feel the same way about their children. They feel the same responsibility. And I just don't believe that someone should have to suffer because they don't have, because they weren't born here. And I don't think their children should have to suffer. And we engaged in this conversation for like 45 minutes. And this woman who was like a LePage voter, who has all of these racist and xenophobic ideas about immigrants, by the end of this conversation was moved to a place of saying, I think healthcare should be given, you know, it should be a right for everyone. And I guess I don't believe anyone should have to suffer, period. Right? And like, that is just an example of like one conversation where you're able to move the needle. And I don't think this woman has, her entire worldview has changed, right? But I think that being able to sit with someone and have a values-based conversation instead of a policy-based conversation right out the gate actually made some space for us to tackle what she, and for her to be able to separate what she had heard versus what she actually knew and believed, right? And I don't think all people can necessarily get to that place in a 45-minute conversation, but I think what I've experienced, that's just one example, but I've experienced lots of conversations like that where people come out with like, well, what about this group that I think, yeah, healthcare for everybody except them, and then we engage them on it. We actually go there with them and we find out that most people's values or that nobody should be suffering, period.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a model that works. And so I think we need to be bold, and also we need to be, for me as a white person going out and talking to primarily other white people in Maine about this, like, I need to be willing to be, like, hold the line on white supremacy while also inviting people to really tell me what are your real values, right? And we need to offer a much more compelling and bold narrative from the left, not just about like, how did we get here, but what are the real solutions forward? And we just, the left, you know, the left, I mean, when I say that, actually, you know, what I'm talking about is like the Democratic Party, they're not presenting a bold set of solutions. They're not saying, here's a path forward to prosperity. They're not doing that. And frankly, Republicans are, whether they're wrong or not, they're coming out and saying, we're going to build this great thing and we're going to have all these jobs. And they just tell lies. But I think there's an opportunity to say something that isn't a lie, but that is very inspiring and compelling and speaks to the best in people, while also holding them accountable for what they say and what, how they behave towards, you know, Black folks, immigrants, et cetera.
Yeah. One of the last things that you had mentioned, was the idea of all of these people who are excited and getting politically engaged for the first time now because of Trump's election, and how to bring those people into work like the work you're doing while maintaining the vision of the work that you're doing that you were just talking about. So I'd love to talk about, hear about how that's going for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a challenge, I think, a sort of happy problem to have, that you have so many people who are saying, oh my God, I want to do something. But a lot of our organizations have actually been pretty small, right? Like really, truly progressive grassroots organizations and movements have been really small. And so suddenly we have this surge of people and we're like, wow, we have to figure out how to absorb them. And I do think that, I think it's really important that those of us who are, you know, radical folks on the left who are doing grassroots and big community-based work right now, I think we should be engaging these newly activated people, many of whom are really much more aligned with, like, the Democratic Party.
Right.
But I think they... And so those folks also, I mean, I've been talking to a lot of people who are more affluent, right, who are showing up all of a sudden, who are, or at least middle class, who have pretty normative views about the world. They hate Donald Trump, but they, you know, they wanted to see Hillary Clinton be president, and they had very few qualms with who she was and her record. And so I think if those of us who... are doing the kind of work that the Worker Center is doing, if we're not doing more to engage those folks who are potentially could be like brought into this much more transformative project, I think we're missing an opportunity. And I think it means we have to teach people what real organizing is. And so a lot of what we're seeing right now is really like civic participation, right? We're seeing people, you know, call their representatives and feel like they've done what they can do, or they're going to rallies and they're doing things that are not necessarily unimportant or wrong, but a lot of folks don't know what organizing is. And so I feel a responsibility as an organizer with a really transformative sort of concept of what's needed. Like we need transformative projects. We need radical projects. We need to build a real movement. I feel like I really have to engage these folks that in the past, honestly, like they haven't been my priority to engage. And I think we need to build something that has a very different scale right now than we are used to. And so I'm trying to balance both like true loyalty to poor and working people in Maine, which is that's where my heart is. And that's where I think real liberation is going to come from. I'm trying to balance that true loyalty and commitment to that with also being like, how can I work with the folks and hopefully have transformative sort of learning experiences with the folks who are new and do not yet have a radical vision of a very different world. They just don't want Donald Trump in office. And I think that's really tough. And so what I do, I guess, is like, you know, in my paid work, I work for a reproductive healthcare and abortion provider, and I am a paid organizer through that role. And so a lot of people are contacting us to talk about Roe v. Wade and saving abortion, you know, the legality of abortion and protecting that. And I use those opportunities to validate that that's something that's really important and also be like, oh, and you know, we're facing cuts on the state level to TANF, to general assistance. These are things that make it really difficult for women to, you know, start or grow families at a pace that they choose, right? And, you know, taking food out of people's mouths is part, you know, that's antithetical to reproductive justice. So let's talk about that. And I feel like there are little ways to push out people's understanding of the problem.
Yeah.
But it's true that we have a huge influx of people who are not trained up. And so I think those of us who are trained up, we need to be giving away everything we know at every opportunity. We need to be willing to go to these groups, and try who are willing to have us and try to train them up on things and try to push them, analytically. And, And also, we need to be trying to get those folks to give their money to truly radical projects. That's not going to save the world, but, you know, one of the things a lot of these newly active folks have is money. And a lot of the folks we work with on a daily basis don't have that kind of money, right? So we need to figure out how to engage them, though. It's because there's danger in some of the narratives that they're presenting, yeah. right? Like, we're a country of immigrants that totally erases settler colonialism and like ongoing violence against indigenous people right here in Maine. Mm-hmm. Right. So that narrative is out there and it's very popular. We need to get, you know, we need to like pull that back. We need to like help people figure out the roots of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. So to wrap up, how can people keep up with you and the organizations you work with?
Maineworkers.org is where the Worker Center is at. Also, we're a part of a 4-state collaborative of healthcare as a human right campaign. So if you go to healthcareashumanright.org, you will also find out about our sort of coordinated strategy with folks in Vermont, Maryland, and Pennsylvania who are also working on this. In Maine, we have to make a lot of things from scratch because we are very different than our neighbors. Here in the North, we are much bigger than Vermont or New Hampshire. Even though we're all very white and rural, we are a very big rock. And so geography creates a problem. We have a lot more in common, I think, with some of our southern states, except we're not as religious. And so whenever I'm on national calls trying to learn things from other organizers around the country, I learn a lot, but I also often feel like in Maine, we are making things from scratch. And so I'm hopeful that if people follow Maine, they might learn some things that they could reshape to fit their circumstances. Other folks who are working in rural contexts and in very white and, you know, conservative and working class contexts. So if people want to reach out to Maine, we want to hear from them.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.